a disciplined way to actually look at problems and sort out whether the problem is really a problem, whether it's a symptom of something else, or whether it's completely wrong. So that idea of being able to harness your curiosity, but actually harness scientific method to get you to the point where you're not expending a lot of energy working on the wrong thing.
Today on the Daily Scoop podcast from the Scoop News Group, the evolution of hacking for defense. Inside the latest cohort of the academic program that connects students to real problems in the national security space. It's Tuesday, April 2nd, 2024. Welcome to the Daily Scoop podcast, where you'll hear the latest news and trends facing government leaders. I'm the host of the Daily Scoop podcast, Billy Mitchell. Here's what's happening now. You heard on last Thursday's podcast that the White House issued the final policy governing how federal agencies will adopt and use artificial intelligence technologies. That policy had been in draft form since last November and open for public comment. While much of it went unchanged, FedScoop combed through the draft and final versions to reveal what the Office of Management and Budget updated as it published the official final version. Among other things, FedScoop found six key notable changes: additional compliance time for agencies to meet risk management requirements, a new section requiring agencies to share custom developed AI code model information, a new requirement for agencies to name AI talent leads, an expanded requirement for all federal agencies to report and release aggregate metrics on use case inventories, another new requirement that agencies have to validate the determinations and waivers that chief AI officers make on safety and rights impacting use cases, and a trio of new procurement considerations when agencies buy AI tools. The final policy corresponds with President Joe Biden's October executive order on AI and establishes a framework for federal agency use and management of the technology. In addition to the requirements already listed, top-line directives include that agencies must now vet their AI uses for risks, expand what they share in their annual AI use case inventories, and select a chief AI officer. In other news, the Biden administration is also looking to modernize and enhance the Federal Risk and Authorization Management Program, better known as FedRAMP. In an announcement late last week, the FedRAMP Program Management Office released a new roadmap highlighting how it intends to embrace modernization. The new roadmap is an acknowledgement from the program's leadership that federal agencies have much more varied needs compared to at its launch 13 years ago, when the top priority was easing the path for cloud computing infrastructure's implementation into the federal government. A blog post on the matter said it is critical that FedRAMP be well positioned to make sure federal agencies get the full benefit of software as a service cloud offerings, adding that while SaaS applications are used in government and FedRAMP does have some in its marketplace, it's not nearly enough and it's not working the way it should. The post goes on to say that for many companies, especially software-focused companies, it takes too much time and money to get FedRAMP authorization. Modernizing the government-wide compliance program for cloud services has been top of mind for Washington IT leaders in recent years, most notably with the passage of the FedRAMP Authorization Act in 2022 and the release of an Office of Management and Budget draft policy memorandum on overhauling program operations and governance in 2023. You can read more about these stories and much more at fedscoop.com. Since 2016, the Department of Defense and other national security agencies have partnered with the Hacking for Defense program, allowing students at universities across the U.S. and now across the globe to address critical problems facing the Department of Defense and intelligence community. Launched as a pilot out of Stanford, the program has expanded to more than 63 universities and listed more than 3,000 students for the course. And more recently, participating universities had partnered with allies and universities in the UK and Australia to work on common problems. This week, the latest Hacking for Defense cohort is beginning, and it's the largest ever, with 37 universities teaching 39 courses, supporting 120 student teams with over 500 students between the U.S. and U.K. Joining the Daily Scoop podcast now to discuss the evolution of Hacking for Defense and what to expect from the latest cohort is Pete Newell, co-founder and CEO of BMNT, the defense innovation firm that runs the Hacking for Defense program. Pete, welcome to the Daily Scoop podcast. Thanks so much for joining us.
No, thanks for the invite.
Really looking forward to our conversation and your joining as Hacking for Defense is set to launch a new cohort, and we'll surely get into that. But, you know, before we get to the news and sort of the information about that new cohort, you know, I'd love if you could start by giving the listeners a bit of an overview of what Hacking for Defense is and why you and folks on the team there got it started.
Sure. Hacking for Defense is essentially a upper-level university or graduate-level course that takes problems from across the government. I really mean across the government. It's not just defense. And puts them in front of groups of students at universities and then recruits those students to actually form teams around the problems to come into what we would call a mission-focused entrepreneurship course. They really take the problem as if it's their job to solve it, to create a company that fixes it, or simply reports back to the problem sponsor that, you know, here's the pathway you should follow to fix this thing. We really intended the course to introduce some of the really wicked problems that folks in DOD and the intelligence community, State Department, Homeland Security, you know, face on a daily basis, to get those students more interested in potentially working with the government, or even if they went off to commercial companies, to get them to the point where they actually had experience working on something real that they could carry forward into their future jobs.
It sounds like the cohorts, the students come from all across the globe in a number of different places. So tell me about the target audience and, you know, where you've brought students in from.
Now, actually, we taught the very first course and launched it at Stanford University. And I still teach the course at Stanford, although it has been taught in 60-plus universities in the United States, the UK, and Australia. So it's actually expanded to a much larger population of universities. The students are recruited from the university student bodies. I think to date we've had about 850 teams participate in the course. And you know, we're excited every year to see, you know, a new set of problems and a new set of students show up and actually take on some really hard things.
And so you mentioned, you know, the goal is to help bring together this ecosystem of students with the partners at a number of places, Department of Defense, Intel Community, State Department, et cetera, to work on those nasty problems. Yeah. So tell me more about those partners and what some of those nasty problems are you've seen the community facing.
Well, I can take the cohort that we have starting up at Stanford right now. We have everything from space problems for the Space Systems Command to there's one particular energy problem for the State Department focused on the island of Barbados. There's you can get everything from advanced manufacturing to food storage to I think we have one focused on sentiment analysis for CENTCOM, which is obviously a big deal with the increased recruitment of the increased online recruitment of folks to groups that are really difficult to track. We've done everything from mechanical to chemical to bio to you name the gamut of challenges that we run across, both from a government standpoint, also from a commercial standpoint. And what we're finding is most of the problems are not just a government problem, is that as the students dig into it, they find that there's a digital twin in the commercial world for it, which really brings a rich group of people together to focus on taking a challenge on and actually moving it forward to a solution.
And is it one of those government partners coming in with a problem, or is it the student coming in with sort of an idea in mind? How do you kind of marry those two together to come up with an idea?
For the most part, we are recruiting problems out of the government. We have a process of sourcing them nationally, and then curating those things down to make sure that the problem is well suited for the classroom. The problem sponsor from the government is actually going to be actively engaged in the course and is not just looking for somebody to write a white paper for them. Occasionally, we have students come to us with an idea, and we will go find a problem for them. Now, I'll give you a great example. There's a company called Capella Space that was formed several years ago. Capella came in with the idea of doing IR imagery from low Earth orbit satellites. And of course, you know, there's not a government agency that says that's one of the problems, because they have billion-dollar satellites to do that from deep space. Well, it turns out that, you know, we found a problem for that was focused on countering illegal commercial fishing. Because illegal commercial fishing is largely done under cloud cover in the rain when you can't track the boats or whatever else. Well, it turns out that that same problem is also the same problem you have when trying to track North Korean mobile missile launchers, that they only move them in the dark and crappy weather. And so here was a team with a great idea for a pretty high-end hardware solution that, when we started digging into the problem, there's a very rich problems out there. Now, several years later, you know, Capella is a fairly large company that's flying, you know, a large number of satellites, doing great work with the government, but also for a lot of commercial partners. It's a great example of what this course has the opportunity to do for students.
That's great. You know, I'm curious, since the you know, you mentioned that there's 60 plus different avenues that the program has been run through. Stanford's obviously the one you mentioned, the new cohorts being produced through. How, if I'm a student or someone who's interested in sort of getting involved with the program, do I have to be associated with the university, or how do I go about kind of getting involved?
Yeah, this is strictly an academic program, so we've been really careful to make sure that we partner with the universities, we partner with the professors. If a student is interested and wants to know where it's being taught, we have a nonprofit that administers the academic program called the Common Mission Project. So you go to commonmission.us, and they can actually pull down a list of universities that are involved in teaching it. From time to time, we get universities, students who come to us and say, it's not being taught at my university, you know, but I want it to happen. How do I get that to happen? And in those cases, you know, we talk students through how do you recruit professors or instructors to get this into the academic program. This is a 4-credit class, and that's part of the benefit, is to ensure that the students who are participating are actually working for a grade and not just doing what I would say science experiments to consume time. The same thing applies to, you know, for instance, we have multiple countries that are interested in launching their own programs right now. In fact, this past week, you know, a great conversation with folks in Sweden, and it looks like the Swedish Defense University and three other universities are going to launch a program. Finland, Estonia, I think I'm talking to folks in Taiwan next week who are interested in launching their own program. So there's a lot of interest wrapped around the idea of getting the government more involved with students and getting students actually to get all that energy and excitement to actually help the government sort out its own issues.
That's great. And it's really exciting to see that sort of, you know, growth internationally and see it expand beyond the U.S. I'm curious, yeah. You know, and I was going to ask this later in the conversation, but it seems like an appropriate time now. What, you know, as somebody who facilitates the program and had the idea behind it, what makes students in a collegiate, you know, academic sort of environment the right way, the right place to approach them for defense innovation rather than, you know, working with people who are inside the U.S. military or inside the Pentagon? Why did you have the idea to target it, you know, at that educational level?
You know, I found that there are probably several answers. I found that the academic environment is like the best, most level playing field where you can bring different parties together and not have to worry about IP and jurisdictions and The classroom, and the classroom is a free-for-all place where the government is willing to come in and work and not worry about, you know, some commercial company taking advantage of something. I find that the commercial companies are hugely interested in acquiring the talent that has the experience that these students get in the course. It is an entrepreneurship course. So we are steeped in sorting out what's really a problem and what's not. How do you build a pathway towards a solution? How do you build a company around a solution? Those things. And then the students themselves are attracted to, I think the best way a Stanford student put it, he said, this is the only course I've taken in my academic career at Stanford that allowed me to use everything I had learned at school to work on a real problem with real people that gave me real experience that's leading me towards the type of job I want to have. It's all real. You know, it's a flipped classroom, so we're not standing up in front of the classroom lecturing. We're pushing students out on this entrepreneurship journey where it can be, it's frustrating, it's hard, it's just like building companies. And you know, the experience they get from it is just not something you find in a typical classroom. But we're also finding that those people from outside who participate as mentors and problem sponsors are getting an education that they typically couldn't get sitting in their offices, because the students are bringing new ideas, they're talking to different people, they're looking at a problem with a fresh set of eyes. And they don't necessarily agree with most of the things they're handed by somebody. So there is this massive uptick in learning for folks that actually participate in it.
That makes sense. And I'd be interested, I would imagine there's tons of different outcomes in terms of what the average student, you know, walks away from the course with. But do you have a sense of what most often happens? Is it the creation of a new entity, a sort of, you mentioned talent acquisition, somebody gets a job. What is the average student who walks away from this course kind of have as an outcome?
I think, you know, by and large, the number one thing that happens on the course is the first pivot is always when the students look at the government and tell them the government they got the problem wrong. So I think from a curiosity standpoint, we're giving the students a disciplined way to actually look at problems and sort out whether the problem is really a problem, whether it's a symptom of something else, or whether it's completely wrong. So that idea of being able to harness your curiosity, but actually harness scientific method to get you to the point where you're not expending a lot of energy working on the wrong thing, is a skill set that is hard to pick up on your own. So first and foremost, students are walking away with that skill set of being able to run a series of experiments against something to determine whether the problem they were handed was even correct or not. And then we're giving them a very disciplined system of how to move that through a series of hypotheses and experiments to get to the point where I know I have the right problem, I know I have a potential solution, and I have built the social architecture for a pathway to actually deliver that solution. That's the thing that students leave with experience doing that is so valuable when they head off, whatever job they head off to.
Yeah. But in terms of, you know, you on your website have some success stories listed and things of this. Sometimes companies do get formed out of this and go on to do, you know, business with the U.S. government and perform some really critical missions. Is that correct?
Yeah. So there have been, out of 850 teams, I think 62 companies have been formed. And of the 62, I would probably say 20 to 25 are truly viable, growing companies. I mean, it's of the 62 companies, they've raised something like $750 million over the last 8 years. So, some of them are really, really good, and some of them are still struggling startups. But they're very informed. They have, you know, they can they go back to the early days in the classroom and say, the fact that I worked on this government problem taught me about the commercial problem that gave me the traction I needed to actually get the capital I needed to get the company moving and launch and do something.
That's pretty incredible. I mean, that's quite a number of companies formed out of it. And I'd be curious, you know, you've been doing this for a number of years. How have things changed over that time since, you know, the initial course pilot was launched? I think it was in 2016, but how have things changed in that period of time? And is the defense innovation ecosystem different? Are there new assumptions? Is there a different understanding of the way things work? Or is it more or less the same as when you first founded Hacking for Defense several years ago?
I think in some cases, I'm surprised that the people who were in the room when we founded Hacking for Defense years ago are all still there. You know, the original partners are still teaching the same class. The defense partners who joined us and provided problems as they've grown up and expanded and been promoted are still providing problems. I think the scale is somewhat surprised us, as you know, we've gone from defense to the intelligence agencies to the State Department, the Homeland Security, to in some cases health and climate. So we very rapidly moved past just defense things to all kinds of social problems. Here this year, we're looking at everything from large language models to help people better understand authorities and policies to, no kidding, hardware problems. So we found that the same process lends itself to policy issues just as well as it does tech issues. And that, of course, has opened up a whole other, genre of things. For the past couple of years, quietly, we've been sourcing common problems for our allies. So I think this is the third year that we have a U.S. Navy and a U.K. Royal Navy problem jointly being worked by universities in the U.K. and the U.S. So it's really interesting to see, different perspective of the same problem, but also different approaches that those teams take towards a solution. So we're starting to see, lots of opportunities like that now get outside not just the traditional industry base that we have in the United States, but now looking at non-traditionals. And then we look at non-traditionals, that it's actually fascinating to see the recruitment that has happened, over an 8-year period.
That's really interesting. So Pete, as we close out, looking ahead to this latest cohort, what would you say is most exciting about it? I mean, you described a little bit about some of the solutions they're looking into, but tell me, what the cohort looks like, what they're going to be working on, and then broadly, what's next for Hacking for Defense as we look into the future?
I would tell you, and I don't think anybody would call me on it. The students get smarter every year. I swear, this is the most challenging course you could ever ask to teach, because you have such brilliant groups of people who are now self-forming around something they have a passion for. So you literally get every group of students just like a baby startup with all the energy and all the drive and all the excitement that comes with it. So from an adult educator standpoint, and from a startup founder and an investor, and this is the most beautiful environment to ever work with somebody in, regardless of what the problem is. I am really excited about some of the problems we got this year. The range is pretty great. So, like I said, it's everything from energy to food storage to large language models to space tracking. And there are a few others in there that I'm probably forgetting, but just the breadth of the things we'll see means that the course will be, fascinatingly interesting for folks.
That sounds great. Well, Pete, it's been incredible to hear about the history and sort of the progress of Hacking for Defense, and definitely want to keep an eye on how this latest cohort comes out. So please keep us posted. But
yeah, please drop in and check on us. We literally kick off the course tonight. We'll be teaching every Tuesday night, Stephen, if you want to stick your head in sometime. We do add a Zoom link for folks who are interested if they want to catch it. It is certainly worth spending a few minutes time with.
Yeah, for sure. We'd love to. And I'm sure some of our listeners would as well. So thanks so much for the opportunity and best of luck for this latest cohort.
And thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You can learn more about defense innovation at thedailyscooppodcast.com. The Daily Scoop podcast is available on all podcast platforms. If you've already rated the podcast on your platform of choice, thanks so much. High ratings and good reviews of the show help more people to find it. Daily Scoop podcast is a production of the Scoop News Group in Washington, D.C. Adam Butler and Carlin Fisher help put the show together, and the entire Scoop News Group team contributes. We'll be back on Thursday with a brand new episode. Until then, I'm your host, Billy Mitchell. Thanks so much for listening.